Thank you very much. So it's a great pleasure to be here. And I have a small number to show to you. What is it? It's close to the number of neurons in all people living in Paris. Or maybe number of neurons in all the bees in France. But it's a number of ants on Earth. So it's a bit an abstract number, so how to make it visible. So if you will take all ants and put them one in front of, the ants are small, but if you will put them one in front of the other one, you can go 165 times to the sun and back. So that gives you an idea about the number of ants on Earth. And so it means there are many ants on Earth. And so it's a huge biomass. There's a single organism which has a biomass which is similar to that of ants on Earth. Yeah, humans. Since last week, humans just reached the same weight as ants on Earth. So that's give you an idea. And it's especially in the tropics that you'll find more social insects than you will find here. And today, so I'd like to talk about polymorphism, so intraspecific polymorphism. So there are many species where you can find some variations. So you can look to people in the audience, they have different shapes and different colors and so on. And so some of this variation is a genetic basis, like in those snails, so difference in the morphology, in the color of these snails are due to genetic polymorphism. But in some other species, it can be due to the environment. So those two individuals will be identical genetically, but depending on when they are born and the environment in which they are raised, they can develop very different phenotypes. Another example is in those fish. Like in many species, you have males and females. The males are beautiful, the females a bit less beautiful, but this is only fish, so. And this can be due to many factors. The sex, which can be environmental, or there can be sex chromosomes. This is, can have a genetic basis, or also an environmental basis, or an interaction between both. And in humans, you find the same also. So you can have individuals which look differently, but which have cognitive abilities which are very similar for those two, or something which is very different in the capacity of the brain. And this is, again, due to genetic differences or differences in the environment. And in that respect, social insects are very interesting because within a single colony, you can find very different individuals. Here you have a queen, here you have different workers. So workers can differ in size and shape, and this can be intense. And the queen is also very different from the workers. So during the first part of the talk, I will discuss that. And then I want to discuss variation in social organization. There are many species of social insects where you can have variation in social organization. And the main difference is the number of reproductive individuals in a colony. In some species or forms, you have a single reproductive individual, the queen. But in the same species, you can find sometimes other social forms which have multiple reproductive individuals. And as I will show, those differences in social organization are linked to many other phenotypic and behavioral differences. So the caste system, so within a colony, you can have different workers, so they differ not only in size, but the shape of different organs. Here you have the males, and here you have a queen. So the queen also is winged, so there are winged queens. When you have mating flights, you have males and females departing on the mating flight. This is a male. And the queens will then lose the wings, remove them, and start its own colony. And the workers can be extremely different. Here you have a worker sitting on the head of its sister. So it's not really the brain here. It's mostly the big head of this soldier, his two big muscles which activate the mandibles. But you can see there can be tremendous variation from a single genotype. And those differences in caste are associated with a different behavior. So in ants, the workers are doing all the work. They go outside, collect the food, they defend the colony. And the queen is not doing much. Just in humans, she's not very active. Here, she's just laying eggs for the colony. But all the hard work is done by other colony members. And those differences are associated with many differences, and one is the lifespan. So social insects are quite amazing in terms of their lifespan. So here you have various groups of insects. And as you can see, an insect doesn't live very long. Typically, it's a few weeks, sometimes a few months. But usually, by the time they reach a few months, they are dead. And there are three exceptions. These are the termites, these are the ants, and the bees. And in some species, the queens can live up to 30 years, which is truly amazing for an insect. It would be like if you would find a primate which lived 4,000 years. And in this phylogeny, we could show that the evolution of social life has been accompanied by an increase about 100-fold in the lifespan of the reproductive individuals, the queens, compared to the solitary ancestors. And it's also a good model to study aging, because here you can have a single genotype which gives the workers or the queen, and the queens typically live 10 times longer than the workers. So it's interesting to see what genes are differently expressed, which allows the queens to live much longer than the workers. And so the question is how to become a queen. Is it due to the environment or is it genetic? So if you look in textbook, it said it's purely environmental. So in ants, if you are males develop from unfertilized eggs. So an ovula, which is not fertilized by a sperm, which is haploid, will give rise to male. And if it's a diploid individual, which is so the egg has been fertilized, you can have either a queen or a worker. And it's thought that it's the environment, the food, or pheromones in the colony, which make an egg developing into a queen or into a worker. But over the last you should never trust textbooks. Actually, there are lots of things which are correct in textbooks. The only problem is it's never sure what is right or wrong. And in the case of social insect, we have found in the last few years quite a few cases where you have different modes of reproduction. For example, in that species, queens mate with two types of males, males from the same genetic lineage, and all the offspring of those matings, so she mates with several males. So the queen, she stores the sperm. She mates only when she's very young. She can live up to 20 years, and she uses sperm of the male she mated 20 years ago. So she is able to store the sperm in the spermatheca. And offspring which are fathered by males of the same genetic lineage all develop into queens, and the offspring which are fathered by males of the other genetic lineage all develop into workers. So for the system to be stable, you need to have two genetic lineage in a population, lineage one or lineage two. They produce the queens that are of pure lineage, they produce males of the same lineage, but they need to mate with the males of the other lineage to produce the workers, which are a type of hybrids. And we have found several other species, many populations, which have this mode of reproduction. After we have found another case in that ants, where queens use two modes of reproduction. They produce new queens by parthenogenesis and workers by sexual reproduction. Why would you do that? So sex is fun. But it's very bad, it's very dangerous. And it's very bad in terms of evolution. Why is sex bad? It's random, more or less, it depends. Sometimes some species, some individuals choose more than the other one. But in any case, it's always bad because it means you make a baby. So I meet this guy, make a baby with him. And I'm going to, so evolution is to transmit your genes, but if I mate with him, I'm going to make babies which have half of the genes of somebody which is mostly unknown, which is really bad. So sex is bad because it means you transmit not only your genes, but also the genes of another individual. But sex can be good also because it can increase genetic diversity. And here they've solved the problem because when they produce new reproductive queens, they use asexual reproduction, so they transmit all their genes. But they keep sex to produce the workers, and so they can maintain genetic diversity within the colony. So they have both the benefit of sexual reproduction and asexual reproduction. And then we found another species, which is essentially the same, but here it's clonal reproduction, so there's no recombination. And that species, it's 100% of the queens which are clonally reproduced, 100% of the workers which are sexually reproduced, and workers are completely sterile. But this is really bad for somebody. Is there a male in the audience here? Ah, yeah, I see one here. So if you were a male ant, so that's pretty bad, basically. It means you fertilized eggs, which all develop into workers, which are completely sterile. So it means males have a zero reproductive success. So what can males do here? Huh? They work. That's one thing they don't do in ants. They never work. It's only females. All the workers will be females. In termites, males work, but not in ants and bees. But they... What would you do if you would be an ant male? Yeah, well... They could transform them to females, so that's what Wolbachia is doing. So when they are into useless males, they transform them into males. But here, males reproduce clonally. So it's not easy to see how so males produce sperm. So sperm are useless in nature. But here what the sperm does is enter the egg. It destroys the maternal genome, so you have a new haploid individual. And this is a male. And that, in that species, actually, all males are produced clonally from their father. All females are produced clonally from their mother, and so it means there is no more gene flow. And when you do a phylogeny using different type of markers, on one part of the tree you have only males, and on the other part of the tree you have only females. So it's like two species, because there's no more gene flow, but they need each other to produce the workers, which will be like the summer. And since then we have found three more species which use the same mode of reproduction, and I think there are quite a few ants which have those very unusual modes of reproduction. So now I move to the second part of the talk, which is variation in social organization. As I mentioned, there are many species which have variation in social organization. And I'd like to thank John Wang, which did a lot of the work I will present, and Ken Ross, which has been a colleague with whom I work since many years. So the work with this is in the Pharynx Solenopsis invicta. The species come from about the same place as our previous colleague, Argentina, Brazil. It has been introduced in the US, and since then it has spread in Australia, in China. And people don't like it very much because it has a very painful sting. And one thought one could control Americans with that, but it's not strong enough. But it's still very painful. And there are two social forms, a form in which you have a single queen. As I will show, it's a large queen. They use independent colony founding, that is a queen's departing mating flight. She mates with one male, and she will start a new colony on her own by feeding her babies from her body reserves. And there is strong aggression between colonies. And there's another social form in which you can have up to 100 queens in the same colony. They are smaller. And after mating, instead of starting a new colony of their own, queens return to an established colony where they start reproducing. And then they will eventually start new colonies by budding, that is, they leave the nest with workers to start a new colony nearby. And there's no aggression between colonies. So when I did my postdoc, I was interested to see if there was a genetic difference between the two social forms. So that was a long time ago. We were using allozymes, which were like we were looking about how proteins were migrating on gels to see difference in proteins. And for most of the proteins, we found there are two alleles or three alleles, and they were same allele frequencies for most of these loci. But there were two exceptions, PGM and GP9. And for those two, there were important variation in frequencies of alleles between the two social forms. So I will present you the data for GP9, which means general protein 9, so we didn't know at that time what it was. But this gene is linked to PGM, so what I will explain you also accounts for the difference at PGM. So at GP9 you have two alleles, a big B and small b alleles, and in the monogenic form, all inverse are homozygote for the big B allele, the queens, non-reproductive queens, which are the young queens which have not yet departed on a mating flight. And workers, everybody is homozygote for the big B allele. In the polygynous form, you also have the small allele, But you have strong deviation from Hardy-Weinberg distribution with more than expected heterozygotes. And this is especially true for queens, so we have genotyped many queens, and all the queens we genotype in the social form, they are all heterozygotes. And we find the same also, there's an excess of heterozygote also for other individuals, and almost a complete lack of homozygote for the small B allele for the three type of females. So we did several experiments, and we found that the small B allele behaved like a recessive lethal allele, so that all females, when they close from the pupae, so when they have the adult form, they will die within the 2 or 3 weeks after eclosion. So we have an explanation for that. But the question is, why don't you have those individuals? And so as you can see, this is most clear for the queens. So we just look for phenotypic differences among queens of three genotypes. And we found that, indeed, there were important variations with size differences, with big B queens being heavier than queens of the two other genotypes. And also, they laid more eggs than queens of the two other genotypes. So, as I mentioned in the polychinus form, the queens depart on the mating flight and try to enter a nest. So we thought that maybe those phenotypic differences may affect the probability of queens to be reaccepted in the colony. So we did a very simple experiment. We took 20 individuals from each of 19 colonies, isolated them 3 days on small units. Usually the queens will dilate and start reproducing. And then we reintroduced them in the mother colony and recorded the behavior. So we noticed that some of the queens will be readily accepted. So they will, when you put them in the nest, they will walk directly to the nest, to the central part of the nest. But some of them will be attacked, like this one. And so here you can see workers are attacking the queens, and it will take less than 3 minutes for the workers to cut the queen in 3 pieces, which in most cases will be lethal. And then we genotyped individuals to see if it was a random attack of queens. And we found that it's not the case. Workers attacked only the big B queens and never attacked queens of the two other genotypes. And we repeated those experiments with older individuals from the same pattern. And there was an age effect. That is, the older those individuals are, the more likely they are to be attacked by the workers. So now we have an explanation for the data of this graph. So those queens do not exist because when they start reproducing, they will be recognized by the workers and killed by them. Actually, when they close from the pupae, there are about also 40% of them like workers. Here, by this time, already one half have been killed by workers, and by the time they are fully reproductive, reproductively active, 100% of them will be killed by workers. So now this is a bit strange because, as you remember, the ones which are killed actually are the queens which are heavier and the more fecund ones. So usually you are taught that in biology that it's good to be strong, to be fit and so. But it seems that workers are killing the individuals which are the fittest one in the colony. And so when we did those experiments, we had no clue why the workers were killing them. Do you have an idea why they will do so? We came up with several good ideas, all being wrong. But then we had an idea that maybe it could be to the effect of a selfish gene. So a selfish gene is defined as a gene which does something which is good for its own propagation, but which is bad for the organism in which it is. And like meiotic drive in Drosophila or in mice would be selfish gene, which can affect the process of meiosis and be transferred to the sperm of the male in which you are with more than 50% chance. So it's a gene which does something which is good for its own propagation. And here we saw that maybe a gene, the small B allele, or something which is linked to the small B allele, will induce the workers which do carry one copy of that allele to kill the queens which do not carry one copy of that allele. And this will be an advantage because it will then favor the reproduction of other queens which have one copy of the small B allele by removing all the reproductive queens which do not have one copy of that allele. So to test that, we did a very simple experiment. We collected the workers which were attacking those queens and compared to genotypic frequencies compared to workers which were around heterozygote twins. And we found that indeed there were almost only heterozygote workers which were attacking the BB queen, showing that it's which is due to the selfish gene. And the cues, we also identify the cues which are responsible. Because when I did those experiments, I noticed that some of the workers which were attacking the queen were themselves attacked by other workers, suggesting that workers would recognize queens based on difference in order, which could be transferred to them, and then they would be recognized by other workers and attacked by them. So to test that, we did a simple experiment. We took some workers, rubbed them on BB queens or heterozygote queens, reintroduced them in the mother colony and recorded the behavior of other workers in the colony. And when we did that, we found that queens, when they were rubbed on BB queens, there was high aggression. So aggression goes from 0 to 3. And actually, even 40% of them will be killed by the nest mate individuals. By contrast, when they will be rubbed on heterozygote workers, there will be low aggression, and they will never be killed by other individuals. So it really shows it's an order at the surface of the cuticle of queens, which allow workers to discriminate between queens of the two different genotypes. So when we did those experiments, we didn't know what was GP9, but Michael Krieger, which was one of my PhD students, did a postdoc with my colleague Ken Ross, and they showed that it's an alderon binding protein, which in insects can carry odors in the hemolymph, in the blood of insects. And interestingly, there are 9 mutations between the big B and the small B allele, and 8 are non-synonymous mutations, indicating that there's been strong directional selection acting on this gene. So this gene could be directly involved, possibly, in order differences between queens and maybe differential perception of workers of different genotypes of the two types of queens. So to summarize this part, in the monogenic colonies, a form with single queen, they produce one type of queens, those BB queens, which fly and start a new colony on their own. And when they have only workers with a BB genotype, they will only accept a single queen, which is the mother queen. By contrast, in the polygynous form, they can produce 3 types of queens, which have different phenotypes. And those phenotypic differences affect what queens can do. The large BB queens, we think they can start new colonies on their own, but we cannot track them because they made several hundred meters in air, so we cannot track them. But they have the same phenotype as queens produced in the monogenic colonies, so we think they can start new colonies on their own. But what we know is that they can never return to an established colony because they will be killed by the heterozygote workers. So the heterozygote queens, which are smaller, they don't have enough fat reserves to start a new colony on their own, but they will be readily accepted in the polygynous colonies. And those ones, they don't have much chance in life. They have only one option. And so when in those colonies, when you have heterozygote workers, they will accept several queens, but they will accept only heterozygote queens. And we did some experiments where we manipulated the ratio of workers, and we showed that you only need 5 to 10% heterozygote workers to have a shift from the type of monogynous to polygynous type of social behavior. So to conclude, we found a single genetic element, so it's either GP9 or something which is linked to GP9, which influences social organization. It's responsible for the presence of two types of social organization. And that was interesting because that was the first genetic element shown to influence social organization in any type of animal. And we found actually that the same genetic element also influences social organization. Actually, it's not 3, it's 5 in the 5 most closely related species of ferns. So now we have a question. Can a single gene, so we show that there are many behavioral differences, order differences, difference in social organization. Can a single gene be responsible of all those differences? Or are there other genes which are linked to GP9, which also take part of those phenotypic differences? So that was a few years ago. So my students said, we need to do a genome. Now it's easy, but that was still hard to do a genome of insects. So this one and those ones said, we need to do a genome. So we did this genome, which was quite boring. But then we got 16 linkage groups, which was very good news, because 16 is also the number of chromosome of finds. And 16 is interesting because this is where you have GP9. And then we had many markers. We did also a linkage map of the many contigs we had. And we found that for one chromosome, chromosome 16, there was a large region without any recombination. Actually, it's almost 60% of the chromosome where there was no genetic recombination between the big B and small B haplotype. And then one did some fish experiments, and he showed that there was a large inversion, at least this big. And now we have more data. Actually, we know that there are three inversions. This is only part of the first inversion, but there's a large inversion which goes up to here. There's another one here and a third one here. And those three inversions prevent recombination between the big B and small B haplotype. And so basically, knowing that, so we have two social forms, three types of phenotypes. So those individuals are only identical at 15 autosomes. We did also genetic studies. There's no difference at the 15 autosomes. But on this chromosome 16, what we call the social chromosome, if you have two copies of the big B haplotype, you have the large queens and this type of social organization. If you have one copy of the small B haplotype, you have the intermediate size queens and polygynous type of social organization. And if you have two copies of the small B haplotype, then you produce this little type of queens. And this is quite similar to something you must be familiar with. There's also one phenotype which is due to that in many organisms. And this is sex. So in many organisms, you have males and females here. They are identical at all, most of the genome. They are quite different in their phenotype. And again, this is due to just one region. And this is a sex chromosome. And we have exactly the same. So sex chromosome is a group of linked genes which have come together. And many genes can move between autosomes and sex chromosomes. And then they are attracted to be in this place because it's good for some genes. It's good to be in females or in males. So any genes which is good for male or female function can be selected to move into or outside of sex chromosomes. And we have a lot of evidence of that, of genes moving to and out of sex chromosomes. And this is the same, so how to produce two very different phenotypes in a single species. It's good to have a group of linked genes, what we call super genes, which stay together, and you don't want to have recombination, because you want to have all the genes which are good for the female or female, male or female function together. And so, if you have two copies of the small B haplotype, it's lethal. And actually, we show when you have no more recombination, it's bad because it allows accumulation of deleterious elements. We did studies and we know that there are actually at the breakpoints of the inversion, there are two genes which are disrupted. And also because of the lack of recombination, there's been a lot of accumulation of transposable elements on the small B haplotype. And so this leads to a degeneration of the non-recombining region, because a small B cannot recombine with a big B because of the inversion, and now it cannot recombine with itself because of the lethal effect. And the Y chromosome, it's also very much the same. Y cannot recombine with itself. It doesn't recombine with the X. And so it also is greatly degenerated. And in most mammals, if you would produce YY individuals, it will also be lethal because the chromosome have degenerated. So here we have something quite interesting. We have a system which produces two different phenotypes, social phenotype or sex phenotype, which is linked to a group of linked genes. So to conclude, we found that social organization in France is regulated by a pair of social chromosomes. When you have more than 10% workers with a small b haplotype, you have a polygynous type of social organization. This region contains about 600 genes. So the question is, what genes are involved? And this is a difficult question because of the lack of recombination. It really behaves like a single haplotype. Now we have a few candidates. We know that there are several other genes which have been duplicated on the small b haplotype, which could be important for the different behavior and, of workers and different order of the queens. So we may try to disrupt them. And so we know that two genes are non-functional because they are disrupted by the breakpoints of the inversions. So these social chromosomes have the same properties as a sex chromosome. So it's a very interesting system to study what is the effect of lack of recombination. And interestingly, there have been now another ant species which has been shown to also have two type of social organization. It's a formica, it's a very different type of ant. And it's also due to a super gene, and it's on a different chromosome, it evolves separately. And so I think there are many species of social polymorphism which are due to those type of super genes. And so there are many species which have the two type of social form, monogyne and polygyne social form. So my prediction is that in many of those cases, because there are behavioral differences, morphological differences, order differences between individuals, this will also be due to a single supergene. Actually, and we know that in France, the six species which have the two social form, it's due to the same supergene, which evolved actually before speciation, about 500,000 years ago. And then after speciation, each of the six species have maintained the big B and the small b haplotype, which is quite amazing, because it means there's probably very strong selection to keep the two social forms in each of those species. And to finish, I'd like to mention the role of serendipity in science. So how we do science is basically we make hypotheses, then we test those hypotheses, we say this is correct, and we continue, or it's wrong, and we try to have new ideas. But a lot of interesting findings in science come just by chance. So when people do experiments, you can find interesting things. And that was the case, for example, for three studies, we had data which didn't make sense. And so we did more experiments, and then we found what we found those unusual mode of reproduction. But many people had similar data. For example, I saw a manuscript by a Japanese guy, and he had a genotype of queens and the sons of the queen at those three microsatellites. And what he found is that the males never had the same genotype as the mother. So in the manuscript, he proposed that every time a queen produces a male, there must be mutations, and which doesn't make much sense. But he never thought that a male could have none of the gene from the mother, because he had read in textbook that we get the genes from our parents. And he never thought that it could be an unusual type of reproduction. And the same is true for the other species. Many people had the data, they couldn't make sense, but they never published anything because they thought that the microsatellites were not working or things like that. And so I think it's very important that there are a few younger people. So it's very important in science to be always ready to find new things. So in most cases, when you have something which is unusual, it's an error in the lab. But when it's not an error, that's probably the way you can find new interesting things. And the same is true also with those markers here. Most people, because we were doing population genetic studies, they would have said, it's not in Hardy-Weinberg distribution, so let's forget about those markers. And actually, there are many studies when you look in the material methods in population genetic studies where you can see what markers people didn't use. And actually, these are probably the more interesting type of markers. But they have not been used. But there are probably many genes under selection which remain undetected because people are not ready to do that. And so I don't want to say that hypothesis-driven research is not good. We have done a lot of stuff like that in several type of organisms in my lab. But we also have found many interesting things in C. elegans, also with robots, where we found that robots can evolve with neural networks. And even robots can, for example, we didn't thought about that. We were conducting experimental evolution with those robots to see evolution of communication. But by chance, we found that they can evolve deceptive communication. And this was just by chance. We didn't expect that. But then we did more studies, and we could show that. And so I think it's very important in science to be open to for strange results. And on that, I will leave you.